Let's bring Rita Louise on, a well-known psychic, a well-known, well, Rita, how would you like to be introduced? I mean, radio personality for sure. You write
really cool chick.
Okay. That's good. Very cool chick. I like that.
And that's actually, we've been playing around with words like ectomythologist or ectotheologian, ectotheologian, you know, kind of like looking at everything that has that surrounds myth and the search of God. So those are words that we've been playing around with using.
Now, if you use exotheologist, that means you can probably get a tax deduction.
I can become a religion.
Yeah, right. You can become Reverend Rita.
Oh, that I'm already that.
Okay, I figured you probably were.
No, but I could have like a cult following and stuff, you know, and people sending me donations. Ooh, that'd be good.
Well, what's your take on all of these people all of a sudden realizing maybe the end of the world may come here? I just got a call today from a lawyer down in Florida whose wife is a very religious Catholic, and all of a sudden she started talking not about the church and not even going to church anymore. She's talking about the end of the world coming and this Planet X is going to shake everything up. We may not survive, but if we do, it'll be a better world when it happens. What's your take on all of that?
We kind of need it.
Well, of course.
As sad as it sounds, but
long as you
know, there's just so much going on politically and economically that, you know, I think being here on Earth, we should be here and be happy. But I don't think anybody's happy right now. I think everybody's totally stressed out, and so I'm kind of a fatalist these days.
Well, you know, we were talking about you being an author. You got a new book out.
I do.
It's not new, not completely new, but it's been out for, what, 3 or 4 months?
Since the end of October.
Okay.
So about 6 months, going on 6 months. Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. You can buy a copy on soulhealer.com or amazon.com. See, Jerry, you taught me so well.
Yeah, you got that plug right in there.
I did it just for you.
You got some interesting reviews on Amazon. In fact, it's an interesting book. Tell our audience a little bit about what it's about.
Well, one of the things that we did is we noticed looking at mythology that if you start comparing stories from one culture to another, they read and sound a lot like each other. And we started just accidentally playing around with the flood story, you know, like the Noah's flood story. And what we uncovered was not that there were separate flood incidences that happened around the world, but they were all repeating the same story. I mean, granted, there were cultural differences and, you know, who warns Noah of the flood might be a different person, you know, whatever. But the storyline was the same. And the only way we could figure out that they were telling the same story is if it all came from one source. And so with that in hand, we realized that when you talk about the story of the gods of old, the flood is really late in the narrative. And so we decided to go to in the beginning and work our way forward. And, you know, when I say in the beginning, and even though that's a biblical line, one of the things that we did was we took the Bible and we put it to the side and said, well, what do these stories tell? You know, we didn't want to write a book that validated the Bible. We wanted mythology to tell us its story. And then if it matched the Bible, it matched the Bible. If it didn't match the Bible, it didn't match the Bible. And what we found was that they indeed parallel each other, even though the Bible has a lot of editing that's been done to it. But the storyline and narrative is relatively the same. And so what we did was present the reader with the myths so that they could make a determination themselves as to what our history or prehistory has been.
And the book, it took a little while to research, I'm sure.
Yeah, it took about 3 years to research and write.
And did you, at the end of the 3 years, did you have the same feeling about what you were going to find out before you started doing the research? In other words, what I'm asking is, did it turn out the way you thought it would, or did you have some surprises along the way?
There are a lot of surprises along the way, Jerry. One of the things that we went into the book thinking, you know, it was a possibility, was that there could have been a earlier race on Earth that, you know, humanity, mankind as we know it, is the descendant of, which that's a theory that's out there. You know, there was the whole extraterrestrial ancient alien theory that was out there. And what we uncovered made it so that there was no way we could write this book without bringing in an extraterrestrial presence into the narrative, or else you have to make up all these excuses and rationalizations as to why things happened. And, you know, they say, you know, keep it simple. And the only way to keep it simple was to include an extraterrestrial presence in the creation of the Earth. And Jerry, this is something that I don't know if you've had many people share on your show. I mean, because I know you talk to all the UFO people and, you know, extraterrestrial people. We believe that actually a group of extraterrestrials came and terraformed the planet, that their presence here actually started, on the Earth, because we put them somewhere else first, but on the Earth about 3.8 billion years ago, with their presence here throughout time. You know, maybe not like physically on the Earth the whole time, but their presence and here. We put them on Mars first, just FYI.
Well, a lot of people say we are Martians. What do you think about that? I guess we came from someplace.
Well, I don't think that there was a fully developed culture on Mars. The way that the myths read, I mean, because we just took the myths and said, this, you know, this is what the myths say. But when you read them, this was the conclusion that we drew out of it, was that a group of extraterrestrials came and started terraforming Mars. And, you know, based on the, I want to say planetary record, you know, but basically about Mars was formed about 4.5 billion years ago. And within 2 million years, it had created the situation that life could have evolved on the Earth, or at least that's what scientists say, that if life could have evolved on Mars, it was in that very early period, which they can't figure out how it went from being like just this rough ball of rock into something that could have been habitable. But then Mars went through the late heavy bombardment period at about 4.2 billion years ago. And like, lo and behold, right after that, life appeared on the Earth, like boom, boom, right after. And
well, maybe they just said, we better get the heck out of here.
That was the conclusion that we came to, you know. Could a group have stayed on Mars? It's very possible, you know, and went underground or did whatever they did. But that's kind of how the story reads, Jerry, is that this rebel group usurped control and took the information, the knowledge of creation, and took off, or were kicked off, one or the other, a little hard to tell, and started a new world. You know, they talk about the golden age in mythology, but the golden age is always associated with this usurping group, or this group of rebels, depending on who's telling the story. And we believe that they're the ones that came and actually started life on this planet and started to terraform the Earth 3.8 billion years ago.
Okay, now the name of that book again is what?
Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods.
Well, we wanted people to pick that up and read it and get, I want to say, an alternative view, but it's not necessarily alternative anymore. A lot of people are coming around to your way of thinking and the way you wrote this book.
I mean, they're coming around, but even people in the, like, ancient astronaut group look at me sideways because we put our dates so far back. And but I think that we have, you know, everything.
How come you put it so far back? I mean, you know, You said a long time ago, not just a few centuries.
Well, there were clues. You know, in the mythological narrative, there were storylines that you would find around the world. And so one of the narratives that we found was this concept of the gods putting the sun, the moon, and the stars in the sky. And so in the Bible, for example, that's on day three. No, day four. But what's interesting is on day three in the Bible, that's where God creates the plants that live on the earth. And I joke around, it's like, well, how could that happen? No sun, no photosynthesis, no plants. And so we thought there maybe was a mistake in the Bible. But when you look at these other narratives, they all say the same thing, that there was this terraforming that happened. Just prior to that event, you know, to that storyline, there's always a war that happens. It's the sky gods against the fertility gods, you know, bringing it into a little more contemporary UFO terminology. We believe that it was a group like the Nordics that were fighting against the reptilians. I mean, that would be using the current, more current vernacular for these groups. And the sky gods won, and the half-man, half-snake, half-fish group lost the war. But right after this war, that's when they start talking about, and they use the body of Pangu, and his bones became the mountains, and his teeth became, or his hair became the trees, and his blood became the rivers. And there is this constant storyline of the planet being formed with the body of a slain god after this war. And so they have this slain god, the body creates the planet, and then the sun, the moon, and the stars are put into place. It's a very consistent storyline that you find around the globe. And the only the place where we found this act of terraforming happening, aka the trees moving onto the earth and mountain building, was taking it back to the Saurian epoch, you know, so taking it back to about 300 a really long time ago, not the whole, you know, not the whole billions of years, but, you know, like 250 million years ago.
Yeah, you talk about a million here, a million there, and then you got a billion, and then all of a sudden you'll be to a trillion. You know, I understand it's hard to keep track.
Like deficit. Come on, Jerry.
I'm impressed, Rita, with you. I mean, after all, you are a PhD. You do have some brains. But you've really gotten yourself involved in this intellectually. Get the name of that book again. The people in the chat room are asking each other about it.
Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods.
Okay, maybe we'll sell a few books. You can send me a commission.
Okay.
So, we've had a lot of fun over the years going different places and doing different things. You still make a lot of personal appearances?
I'm still doing a lot of that. This last 6 months with the release of the book, I've been on the radio a lot. And, you know, I'm still doing what I do, Jerry. And I just miss you to death that, you know, I haven't seen you at some of these events, but I'm really glad that you're feeling better. And I get to talk to you on the air, Mr. Jerry Pippin at jerrypippin.com.
That's right. We've had a lot of fun in some of our personal presentations of always sneaking the plug in.
And but I have to tell you,
you've helped me.
Coming up here, wait, let me just say this real fast, totally off the, there's a show coming up here in Dallas that I'll be at. It is the Granbury Paranormal Expo. And guess who's going to be the MC for the show? You'll never guess. Dennis Balthizer.
I was going to guess it. Honest, I was. You know why? Because he told me the other day he's going to be in Granbury, Texas.
Oh, really?
He didn't say he was going to be the MC, but tell me about that conference. When does that happen?
It is May 8th, May 18th in Granbury, Texas.
So where are they going to have it there?
I don't know. in Granbury. It's not big. I think it's at their civic center or convention center. Granbury's not very big, so it's either the civic center or the convention center.
Here comes a plug for you. Is it going to be on your website?
It will be, but see, I just got booked into it this past weekend, so it hasn't gotten there yet.
So
it will be.
It'll just be there, and you tell people your website now. You missed the plug. You had a chance.
Soulhealer.com, sorry. But if they go to soulhealer.com, they can find out about the show I'll be at in 2 weeks, which will be the History, Haunts, and Legend Conference in my favorite spooky Jefferson, Texas, where you and I got to hang out and do some interviews and stuff.
You know, we still have that series on our website. And we haven't promoted it in years, but it still gets lots of visitors. It gets a couple, 300 people a week listening to it.
Wow.
So,
cool.
Weedville is the most haunted town in Texas. And whether it is or not, I don't know, it sounded like a good handle. It is haunted. You can testify to that.
It actually has been listed as one of the top 10 in the country.
Now we're in Granville, wait a minute, I'm lost now. No,
in Jefferson.
You lost me there, Brent. You traveled too fast.
Sorry.
In Jefferson, where are you going to be doing this?
That is going to be at the convention center in Jefferson, which is on April 6th. And it is on soulhealer.com if you want more information.
Is that haunted hotel still open?
Jefferson Hotel? Yes, it is.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun there. There were a lot of interesting stories coming out of there. Pretty scary, some of them. And you actually went in there in a trance, for lack of a better term. Would you explain to your audience how you do that? You kind of pick up vibes from people on the other side. Is that right?
Right. I mean, I'm not a medium, so I don't, talk to the ghosts. But I am very visual, so I can see them, and I'm very empathic, and so I can kind of tap into their emotional energy and tell you what they're like and, not what they're thinking, but what they're feeling and what they're experiencing. And so it's really kind of fun. I always joke around that I'm scared of ghosts, but I'm really not scared of ghosts. I'm just scared of the dark. And so the ghosts really aren't that bad. I haven't met a ghost that I really actually hated. Or was scared of. I think some of the people that do the investigations are maybe a little scarier than the ghosts. That's a joke. No mean cards.
Oh, yeah. Little humor, a little troop and some humor.
But Jefferson is really a cool place to visit. I mean, if you're into ghost hunting, there's ghosts everywhere.
Yeah, why do you think that is? I guess it was a Civil War place that had some terrible things happen. Why did they all center around Jefferson? I mean, it's, East Texas is okay, but.
Well, I mean, from what I understand, it was a very bustling city at one point in time, and it was a trade city. And it was a port city because they would take the cotton that was grown in all these different areas and then take it down to Jefferson, and then they would export the cotton from Texas down the river. I don't even know what river that is. And it would end up on the Mississippi and get shipped off. And so, after a certain amount of time, that whole industry, not the cotton, but the railroad took over the job that they were using the river for. And so that town went from, it could have become a ghost town, but it hasn't. And so there's still people that live there, but it still has this old world charm, and a lot of the hotels, I mean, I'm kind of giving away some secrets here, were brothels. And so that energy is very evident. I mean, it really had the feel of, kind of the Wild West there.
I remember those couple of days that we were there, and we taped day and night. And remember late at night before we went into the hotel, we sat outside on a bench here. It's a brick street, and it was like you're back in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. you already were beginning to feel the vibrations,
mm-hmm,
of what was going on there. And we urge people to consider going down to Jefferson. And once again, the plug is April 6th. Is that right?
April 6th. That's correct. All day. And there's investigations all night and a ghost walk. It's really a fun event and a full day event. Hey, but you know what? Also, Jerry, last week I just released my Dark Angels book, An Insider's Guide to Ghost Spirits and Attached Entities, in the Kindle format. And I talk all about Jefferson in that book also.
I like the title, Dark Angels. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, when I think of an angel, I think of a being without a body. But when you think of a ghost, it's a being without a body. And if you think of like a demon, it's a being without a body. And so I just kind of figure, well, if they're all beings without bodies, then if he's talking about a ghost, it would be a darker angel than an angel. And then if you're talking about a demon, it would be a really dark angel. And so, you know, the book looks at starts with ghosts and talks about the bad kids on the block. You know, we don't talk about those goody two-shoe angels and spirit guides. We just talk about the bad kids in the book.
Well, good.
But right, it's a fun book.
Yeah, that's where first right down my alley.
That's right.
When we talk about all these things, so one time you told me you didn't like to hang out at graveyards because you didn't think spirits would hang around there. They'd be someplace where the things were alive and going good. Do you still stand by that statement, or did I misquote you?
I mean, I pretty much stand by that statement. I mean, one of the things that I personally find at graveyards is that there is so much emotional energy there that it's almost impossible to read anything. You know, and it's not necessarily the energy of the dead people. It's the energy of the people that were alive that were mourning over the graves. I mean, you don't have to be dead to leave your energy around. And so you go to those places and you just can't help be struck by sadness and grief and pain and heartbreak. And, you know, ghosts are going to stay places where they're comfortable, where they wanted to be in life. And so why would they hang around a cemetery? I mean, that just doesn't make sense. You know, they're going to hang around in their favorite house, you know, in their favorite room, be around the people that they love or want to torment, one or the other. From a conceptual point of view, it doesn't make any sense. And people go, yeah, but it's a ghost. It's like, yeah, but ghosts are people too. They just don't have bodies.
Have we decided in our own mind, your own mind, why some people are ghosts and others aren't? Or is everybody a ghost?
Well, I have experienced people who have died and crossed over, you know, like they've gone into the light and, you know, had their life review and, you know, and they'll come back and visit people. It is very normal. It's a very normal characteristic to have these people come back, you know, for a wedding or the birth of a baby or whatever. I mean, especially, you know, within like 30 days of the person passing, they usually will make the rounds and say goodbye to everyone. But to have them come back for special occasions, it's just not an unusual thing. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad. I mean, there are sometimes these individuals, you know, will almost act like kind of a guardian angel and watch over certain people for their whole lives. So, you know, it's a ghost doesn't mean that they're bad or they're stuck on Earth.
Oh, where do they go? Have you decided? I mean, when they're not hanging around.
Not really. Tahiti, I hope. Somewhere good.
Okay. folks, as you can see, this is a freewheeling conversation. And we haven't talked about UFOs, but we'll in a moment. And then we're going to talk about a trip down to Peru. Are you going down there?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
June?
We'll talk about the tour and how people can go and all that. Like next hour, we're going to bring a guy named Brian, how do you pronounce
Forrester.
His last name?
Forrester.
Okay. We'll find out a little bit about what's happening down in South America. That is a very mysterious place, Peru and everything down there. And I didn't realize you were even interested in that part of the story, but I should have known better. You're interested in it all, right?
Anything that's, you know, kind of an alternative thought area, you know, and we'll talk about this more, but one of the things that Brian and I are going to be doing is really doing some remote viewing work and trying to connect with the spirits to identify dates, identify who built the structures, you know, so we're not looking to, you know, yeah, we're going to go and touch and feel and look, but we're hoping to tap into some of the psychic energy of the locations to explore it in that way. So it's going to be really a very different approach to this tour than many of the other ones do.
And stay tuned, folks. We'll tell you how you can still go. I mean, you can still make reservations, right?
Yeah.
Okay, don't go away, folks. We'll tell you all about that later in the show. But remote viewing, somehow I just knew you'd probably be interested in that too. Do you remote view?
Well, I mean, I believe, I'll say it this way, I believe that remote viewing is a psychic thing, regardless of what remote viewers want to say, because the things that they do are just a very proceduralized method of tapping into psychic information.
Well, I don't think you'll find a big disagreement with all of them. Some of them like to pursue it as a science completely, but there's a psychic ability is very important in that. But mm-hmm. I guess we all are psychics, I guess, if we wanted to use that energy, or do you think it's a special gift? You're a psychic. I don't know if I am or not.
I think everybody has psychic abilities, you know, other than, like, do you remember Vicky from my group? She didn't have any psychic abilities. She's the only person I've met on the planet that really, not a drop. But, you know, they say, you know, psychic abilities is like dancing or drawing a picture. Some people are very good at it naturally. Other people, not so good. But you do some training and take some classes and you might become exceptional, or you might become a little bit better, but still not great, you know. But it's a skill set.
We are talking with Rita Louise here, radio personality.
From soulhealer.com.
And good, you got the plug in. Congratulations.
Thank
and
you.
And I should, in all deference to your education, say Dr. Rita Louise. You worked hard for that PhD, and you've made it work. I mean, you've written how many books?
4.
And you've had all kinds of things going on. What are you still working with the medical profession?
You mean doing alternative health work?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have to pay my bills somehow.
Okay, well, tell people what you do there. And tell me a little bit about this alternative health care and what you do. You wrote a book about that, especially, if I remember.
Avoiding the cosmic 2x4. But see, yeah. Jerry, you knew me before I was Dr. Rita. You just knew me when I was like Reverend Rita or Rita the Psychic Chick. You know, so
I kept asking you for a deeply religious experience. So yeah,
I love you, Jerry. Soulhealer.com. Anyway,
we've known each other a long time.
A long time. And so what I do in my private practice is I'm a naturopath and a medical intuitive. And a medical intuitive is a person who has a psychic ability that talks to you about health. And I am able to see inside people's bodies and tell them stuff that's wrong with them. What I find works best is, as opposed to someone scheduling a session, this could be in person or by phone or Skype, however, you know, as opposed to me, the person calling and saying, well, you're the psychic, you should tell me what's wrong with me. You know, people already know where their owies are. And so if you say, well, you know, there's something going on with my stomach and I don't really understand, or, you know, I have this kind of ache or pain, it just saves a lot of time and we can really dig into what's going on and explore, Is it a physical thing? Is it a functional thing? Is there a big emotional component tied to it? You know, what other factors are causing you to experience disease in your body? And then come up with a strategy to start addressing what's going on. So that's what I do in a nutshell.
You've been doing that for a long time. And how's your track record?
You know, and this is me not trying to be boastful. I'm going to say, you know, at least 85%. You know, one of the things with this field is that, you know, you don't have people calling you up every day and going, well, you know what you told me was exactly right, or that's the work that you did with me worked. You know, and so you do stuff and you may or may not find out about it. You know, for example, I did a session. It was at a psychic fair. And this woman came, and she had this inflammation in her gums. She actually had one of her teeth pulled, and the tooth went up into the sinus cavity, and there was a hole, and it was all infected, and she wanted me to work on it, and I had 15 whole minutes. And so I worked on her and did this stuff and cleared it out and put this, like, psychic antibiotic in it and, you know, did these little psychic sutures in it. And my 15 minutes were up, and bye, see you later. You know, didn't really think anything about it. So like 3 months later, I get a phone call from this woman who turns out to be the sister of the woman that I worked on. And she goes, she didn't call you? I'm like, no, why? She goes, after she left that night, she woke up and her sinuses just started to drain and drain and drain and drain and drain. She was up all night. And she goes, and because she was supposed to go to the dentist like that week, and if the hole hadn't sealed up, they were going to go in and surgically seal it. And she goes, well, then she went to the dentist, you know, a few days later, and not only was the hole sealed up, but bone had started growing in where they had taken the tooth out. Now, you know, who know? I mean, I don't know how often weird stuff like that happens, cool stuff like that happens, but it happens, but you don't find out.
But you're confident that you do well.
Yeah, I mean, that is the feedback that I get from the people that I know.
Okay. And you've been doing this a long time, so you have a
about 20 years.
Yeah, so, that's a long time.
That's a long time.
And so you started when you were 5, but no.
That's right.
We had a caller, and they wanted to ask something about, UFOs, and we lost him. What about UFOs? Do you believe in UFOs? Do you believe they're extraterrestrial? Have you seen a UFO? Any of those questions, answer them.
I have not seen a UFO. Based upon the research that we did for this book, I certainly believe that we are not alone, because I believe that the bulk of the stories that come to us from ancient mythology is talking about the lives and times of these extraterrestrial beings and their wars and their really bad behavior. What's interesting, Jerry, and you'll appreciate this one, is that, you know, there's all the stuff that comes out about, you know, the underground base at Dulce and all of these underground installations with the reptilians in them and blah, 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 blah. Mythology actually supports many of their claims. And the part that I haven't figured out is, did they base their material on from mythological sources and they're just kind of taking that the next step? Or, you know, using somebody like Anthony Sanchez as an example, you know, did he get the information from somebody over there from the UFO community and it just so happens to parallel themes and concepts that come from remote antiquity?
Yeah, you mentioned Anthony Sanchez. He's doing well these days. And his interesting book on not only just Dulce, but UFOs in general, has some aspects to it that a lot of people didn't want to embrace. I'm kind of agnostic about it. In other words, you know, what he's writing could well be true about that Dulce's been around for a long time, and these people were were manufactured beings, and they stuck them here on Earth because they knew the sun would kill them, so they're out running around at night. I know I've kind of screwed up his story a little bit, but basically that's the thesis of it. And so, you know, he has some sources. It's interesting that so many people attacked him right off the bat. And when that happens, I've always figured there's well, there's smoke, there's fire. So if somebody's protesting too much, that just kind of turns me on.
Well, you know, when Anthony was on my show and I got a copy of his book and I was writing the last chapter or two of the book, I mean, we were really in the conclusion area of it, and I was blown away. I mean, I was just like bouncing around my house because the story that he shares from the current Colonel X paralleled so much of the mythology, you know, that there were these underground bases around the world that the inhabitants, you know, some of the inhabitants of the lowest realms, the seventh level of these bases were called, in India, they were called Nagas. Snakes, you know, obviously reptilian in nature. You know, this whole thing about these half man, half fish, half man, half snaky people.
In the Bible, in Adam and Eve, they talk about the serpent having legs, and then after he talked to Eve into doing the original sin, you know, he'd be on his belly. So, I mean, that kind of backs up the reptilian story right there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But I'm just trying to think of what else. We also came to the conclusion that there were some issues with the light on the planet. And we believe that the giants, you know, the Nephilim, and I have a whole big issue with a lot of people on the Nephilim, but that the Nephilim were actually the preceding race to mankind, and they might have been the ones that Anthony is referring to that had the issues with the light. Because there was a race on Earth prior to the development of mankind as we know them that were giants, and you know, and they were annihilated, basically, with the flood, along with a lot of other people and a lot of those underground beings as well as mankind. Everybody. Jerry, it was everybody but me and you.
Yeah, let's get the name of the book again.
Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, available in paperback and in the Kindle version, soulhealer.com.
Now, I knew you before you really started doing lots of UFO shows, and now you pretty much, that's a regular part of your program. You have UFO people on quite a lot. And what got you interested in that? Since you didn't have an experience, I didn't have an experience either. I did see a UFO later in life. Have you seen one?
No.
I thought you said that earlier. No. Thought I'd ask you again. I've seen one, and I was doing a radio show at the time, which is kind of amazing. And it's on our website if somebody wants to go over to the Phoenix Lights. No, it wasn't the big one like everybody saw. This was later, a follow-up. Standing by the Twin Peaks, and out comes a flying triangle while I'm interviewing a guy. It's just amazing. So I have seen one. Now, I don't know. A lot of people say seeing a UFO is a life-changing experience. It may well be. I don't guess I got close enough to it, but I've been doing UFO shows forever, for decades, so maybe it wouldn't change my life because it didn't change my idea. I've already believed in them.
Well, you know, I still tell people I'm not a UFO person. You know, I definitely am more of a, you know, mythology. I'm a psychic mystic. Anyway.
That's a good title. Dr. Rita Louise, psychic mystic.
And I'll just be frank with you, Jerry, because, you know, we're buds. It's still a little challenging for me to do shows where we're just talking about, like, Roswell or... You know, some of the incidences.
Wait a minute. You enjoyed your trip to Roswell, didn't you?
Well, I had a great time, especially bugging Dennis Balthaser, because that was fun.
And you joined us there 1 year, and we had had a great time. And somebody didn't like your tinfoil hat, but that's beside the point.
Well, I'm going to have to bring Bitsy, too, because he hates her, too. But anyway.
some of them get a little uptight about nothing, but that's what I thought about Anthony Sanchez. I thought they were getting uptight when he has as much proof for his ideas as other ufologists have proof for their ideas. That's one reason
And that's the part that I think is really kind of funny, is that people will put out material that's just like really out in left field and put out this claim like, this is true. You know, the pyramids were these space weapons to knock out the aliens that were in low orbit. It's like, where did you get that? I mean, some of the stuff that you hear coming is just really bizarre. You know, at least if it's approached with humility and they say, well, this is what I've researched and this is what I think is one thing. But when they put it out like this is the God's honest truth, and if you say anything, to the contrary, you're wrong. Like,
okay, so you, I agree with you, by the way, on that. I don't want to pick a fight with my fellow ufologists. They're welcome to believe in what they believe in. And, I don't want to knock anybody with strong principles, because I think it's an important asset if you believe in something and you really push it. But I do think you need to be open-minded as well.
Mm-hmm.
And your book and your theory about how we started and all of that, sounds okay to me. Sounds like that's a logical thing, and you've done some research to back it up. So at least some people, if not all people, should take a look at it and read the book and get a feeling for it all.
Well, and I want to just do a shout out to Lisa, because she already got a copy, and she put a little note in the email that says, "Awesome, listening to your interview with Jerry right now on IRN." So thanks, Lisa. I will make sure that your book is autographed.
Well, good. So they could actually contact you on your website and get an autographed copy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a
good. They don't come autographed on Amazon. Just directly from us, and that's priceless, Jerry.
Well, it may be someday.
One of the things with this book, with Man Made: The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, is that we just put out the information. You know, this myth says this, and this kind of, this group says this, and this group says this. But when you take all of these different stories out of the whole, you can't help but go in a direction or not. And then, we'll put in questions like, well, could this group of rebels actually left the planet? And, and we just would put out questions for you to think about, but we never in this book said, well, this is how it is, because we don't know. We're just taking the evidence available and coming up with some kind of a conclusion, maybe, if that makes sense.
I talked to Ryan Foster the other day. He's coming up here to join us in just a second, about the tour to Peru. And Brian says he's seen a UFO, so we'll have to bring that up with him.
Okay.
We're going to take a break here, and we'll be back and talk about, if they can afford this trip, it's something that will last a lifetime for them in memories, because you guys have really put a lot of work into putting this this tour together. And we'll talk about all that when we come back. Okay, Rita?
Okay, sounds good, Jerry.
But right now we're going to pause for this word or two, and then we'll be back, and we'll talk about Peru and ancient mysteries. And
soulhealer.com.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, too. Don't go away. Okay.
That's right.
We'll be back, folks. We'll be back. When we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat. Rita Louise is with us. Dr. Louise and I have been talking for about an hour, and we mentioned a little earlier about our trip to Peru. Well, I'm not going, but I wish I could, and I would, guys, if my health were better, but I'm tied up right now with some medical issues. But it sounds like a great trip. And Brian Foster, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
And how are things down in Peru? You're outside Lima. They're in a flight pattern, I understand.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
It's not bothering me, but Joe Champion, our producer in Chicago, seemed to pick that up. So I guess an airplane flew over or something. I don't know.
Yeah, Lima's a huge city with 10 million people. So unfortunately, there's traffic all around me at the moment.
Now, how long have you been in Peru?
Off and on for 7 years.
And the reason I ask is because you've been doing tours for a while.
Yeah, about 3 years now.
And you've had some pretty interesting ones in the past. Rita Louise, you can join the conversation with us.
Okay.
Good. And Rita, how did you and Brian get together? I mean, this trip to Peru, I guess the best way we ought to approach this is, Rita, why don't you kind of give a background about the trip, then I'll ask Brian some questions.
Okay. Well, I mean
like when you're going to do it, and then how you do it, and what's going to happen.
The trip is scheduled from June 1st to June 12th. That's with the extension. It's 7 days plus an extra 3 days, 4 days. That is an optional piece. Basically, you fly to Lima, and then everything is taken care of there, transportation, hotel, all that good stuff. And then you have fun. I don't know. I'm not very good at marketing this part.
Well, I'll get to Brian, and I'm sure that he will.
He's much better at it.
Yeah, have all the details here. Brian, we did get the date from Rita on this. Let's talk a little bit about how do I get there. Do you have a does the tour include the airfare down to Peru?
No, the actual international flight is separate, but everything else is completely contained. So transportation, hotels, entrance to the sacred sites, breakfast, etc. The lunches and dinners are separate, but everything else is taken care of.
By the way, I would be remiss before we get into this too far. Lisa in the chat room, she ordered a book, I think, from Rita. But in addition to that, she's donating a little bit of her 5 paychecks to a no-kill animal shelter near her. And we'd urge other people to do that as well. Okay, Brian, let's get down to the brass tacks about this. What's going to happen here on this tour?
Well, basically what it is Peru and Bolivia are probably two of the most fascinating and enigmatic places on the planet, almost as much as ancient Egypt is, because so little is known by conventional archaeology. There are buildings made out of stone, which conventional archaeologists say were made by the Inca, but we found out that it would be physically impossible for the Inca. They didn't have the technology. So what we're looking at through having had a number of engineers and stonemasons, etc., here is a culture that dates back probably at least 10,000 years, and that is much farther back than conventional archaeology admits, but we have the science to back it up.
Well, and one of the other things that's very interesting about Peru is that when you talk about early, early civilizations around the world and the advent of different characteristics of these civilizations, you know, one of the things that you talk about is the development of agriculture and the domestication of food items and plants and animals. And where you find that occurring is, one, in the Middle East, in the Sumerian area, Babylonian Fertile Crescent area. You find that happening in China, and you find that happening in Peru, which is interesting because if people are of the belief that everything started in the Fertile Crescent and then kind of spread around, well, it started in the Fertile Crescent, and then within about 1,000 years, they started having domesticated plants and animals in Peru, which also leads you to believe that there's something else, something much bigger going on than the natural spread of culture and customs around the world.
Exactly.
What do you think, Brian? The Inca civilization is puzzling to me to begin with. I mean, they came up with a lot of things that they shouldn't have been able to do when we first discovered them down there. I mean, you know, they were the cutting-edge things that they constructed. I mean, they were better than any instruments available.
Oh, definitely. Well, yeah, the most recent information I'm discovering, because actually I'm reading a compilation of probably the best chronicles ever written about the Inca, is I have a drawing that was made by the Spanish as soon as they entered the city of Cusco. And what it shows is that the megalithic buildings were there much, you know, much farther back than the Inca, and that the Inca repaired them. So that's evident when we visit Cusco, is that you see where the incredible stone masonry work is. You don't find any really intact buildings. You find later Inca inferior repairs to them, but that gives more evidence that there was a very highly evolved civilization several thousand years before the Inca, and that the Inca simply inherited the city of Cusco.
We're going to get into great detail about this and go over the tour a little bit here in a moment, Brian. But before we do anything else, as I told you in an email, I do a UFO show, so we need to mention some UFOs. And you said you've seen some UFOs down there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I've had two sightings in my life. One of them was in Hawaii about 16 years ago on the island of Maui, and I saw a tube-shaped metallic object for about 10 minutes that was barely moving, and my brain went through the natural processes that you go through of saying, well, is that an airplane? No. Is it, you know, is it this? No. That? No. And so that was my first sighting, and it was very difficult for my brain to process it because it was such a strange object.
Could you make it out very easily? I mean, did you hear any noise or anything?
No, actually, it was in the distance. It was up on the side of the mountain called Haleakala, and it was the size of a conventional commercial aircraft, like not as big as a 747, but some, you know, 727 kind of size. But, you know, my brain went through the natural things. It's like I went, that plane isn't on the right flight path. And then my next thought was, it doesn't have a tail. And then it doesn't have wings. And it doesn't have an insignia. And it's not moving very fast.
Yeah, right.
and so, you know, naturally my brain was trying to find a box to put it in, but it couldn't. And that's why I was transfixed by it. I literally couldn't take my eyes off of it. And then it basically just disappeared.
Blinked out, you mean, or faded away? Or?
Well, we had to go in and out of trees as we were driving. And so I kept seeing it. So we'd go through the trees, and the object was there. Go through the trees, the object was there. And literally it looked like it couldn't have been traveling 100 miles an hour. It was moving that slowly. And then finally we were getting, as we were getting closer to it and closer to it, then we came through another grove of trees, and it wasn't there. It had just, you know, suddenly disappeared, and I scanned the horizon for the next hour trying to find it, and there was simply no sign of it.
This was a daytime sighting, I take.
Oh, it was. It was about 4 o'clock, 4 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The sun was still up, And the other sighting I had, my wife and I both saw a cluster of 12 little objects in a like a cluster or a ball. This was at Paracas on the coast of Peru less than a year ago. And they were coming in from the ocean, a distance of several miles, I would guess. But it was the odd thing, again, is that my brain went through the natural thing, processes. It's like it was midnight, so there were no birds flying in a ball at that time. Planes can't do that. And they were moving amongst each other. It's not like it was a formation. It was a ball formation with them twisting and turning and changing position. They moved inland for about 5 minutes and then stopped and then started to come back the other way. And I was watching it by myself. And I finally got my wife out of bed to look at it because I needed a witness. And she just looked up and she said, "Those are ovnis," which is Spanish for UFOs. And in Peru, it's so common to see flying saucers that local people don't understand why we have this incredible interest. But then after that, they basically moved straight up and disappeared.
How many were there, you think?
There were either 12 or 13. And there
quite
was
a lot.
In such a tight formation, and the color of them, they were glowing, but they weren't glowing white, and they weren't glowing yellow. It was a shade of color that is not in the natural spectrum, as far as I can tell, and there was no moon, so they were not reflecting light.
So UFOs are pretty common down in that part of the world.
Oh, very, especially around Cusco and Lake Titicaca. Local people around Lake Titicaca will tell you that they have sightings at night where a disc, often it's somewhere between 20 and 100 feet in diameter, will simply enter the Lake Titicaca and then come back out again. And
so
that's been going...
They literally submerge themselves in the lake?
Yeah, and stories like that go back hundreds of years. And again, the local people see this, and they see balls of light, self-directed balls of light, so commonly that they kind of smile when we ask questions because it's such a common occurrence.
Now are you going to both of these places in this tour? This tour that we're talking about?
Definitely. The main center we're going to is Cusco.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, and then Lake Titicaca is an option afterwards.
Okay, let's we're going to talk about the whole journey here and the vacation and how much it cost and all of that. And we gave Rita's website. You have a website for these tours as well. Why don't you give that right now?
Sure, that's www.hiddenincatours.com.
And you've given some pretty interesting ones in the past that you've have videos of right there on that website. It's an interesting website.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, now, Rita has written this new book you're aware of, in which she says we're, creatures from other places, basically. And that's the first question I have. Every time I think about South America, people like the Aztecs and the Incas especially, you think they were Earthlings originally or transplanted here, or you have a clue?
Well, the curious thing that I've been studying is, again, with the ancient sites which predate any known culture and are of a sophistication beyond anyone's capability except maybe us now, is that there's also the phenomenon of cranial deformation or elongated skulls that you find, and especially around Paracas where I had the UFO sighting and studied these skulls intensively for more than 2 years, they genetically don't seem to be related to other people in Peru. So the question is, where did they come from? They also had reddish hair, and they died out about 2,000 years ago. So
I wonder why they died out.
They were as far as I can tell, the famous Nazca lines that people would have heard of, the Nazca culture, I believe, exterminated them, and
so
the Nazca themselves were not
eliminated.
Yeah, basically.
You've made quite a career about those elongated skulls, and they are a mystery.
Very much so.
And people need, you've got some features about that as well as available. Rita, are you going down there for the tour?
Yeah, and I get to, like, touch everything and commune with an elongated skull. I'll think of you while I'm touching it, Jerry.
Yeah, please do. So people, this is a good chance not only to find out about elongated skulls and find out about Peru, and Brian will get serious here in a moment, but it's also a chance to get to know Rita.
Exactly.
Well, you know, and one of the things that is going to be really cool, you know, there is a lot of controversy, especially around those skulls. Are they human? Are they alien? Are they some kind of human-alien hybrid? And, you know, I believe, you know, both through my psychic work and working as a psychic investigator doing ghost hunting stuff, that we will be able to actually commune and communicate with the spirits of those elongated skull people and get to know who they are. Some understanding of who they are. And so that's one of the things we're going to get to do. All the people that are there are going to get to strengthen their psychic skills.
Rita, when you're talking about psychic skills, does it help if you touch the object like an elongated skull? And is that possible, Brian? Are they someplace where you can touch them, or you just are they locked away in a museum, or what?
Well, that's the best point is the fact that when I started to get really interested in these skulls, I was really offended by the fact that they were always behind glass, and the, you know, museum people were like, no, you can't photograph them, you can't touch them, etc. So the little Paracas Museum that is part of the tour that we're going to be visiting, we have 38 of them, and they're behind glass, but we open up the glass cases and take them out so people can handle them.
So Rita actually would, for lack of a better term, get a feel for it. In other words, Rita, do you think this helps you with your psychic ability to actually reach out and touch something? Do you get vibes that way?
I mean, for me, all right, don't tell Brian this, but no, not really.
You mean Brian made a deal to send you all the way down to Peru? And
to touch them. I mean, some people... You know, it's really how you connect with things. And so some people, you know, if you're doing a reading, they need to touch your hand. They need to have that physical contact. You know, for me, I like people to sit in their own chair, and I energetically reach out. So whether they're behind the glass or not, I've never dealt with glass, but I don't know that it would bother me that they were behind the glass.
Okay, when
but
you get
there
back.
But there are physiological things, you know, like my little doctor brain goes off and it wants to look and it wants to be able to turn them over and actually do kind of a physical examination. So there's the psychic part, but then there's, you know, doing more of an examination of the skull to look at, you know, the dentition or the cranium, you know, how big that cranium is, because some of them look huge and they look like, Jerry, my opinion is with some of them, if you had a head with the back of it sticking out so far, you know, you'd be looking up at the sky all the time or you would fall over because they look like they're big and they're heavy. Either that or you would have a really sore neck all the time just holding your head straight to keep that pointy part, you know.
Brian, compared to a regular human skull, or how much bigger are these skulls?
Well, the thing is there's so much variation to them because, again, conventional archaeology says that they're all the result of cradle boarding or cranial deformation, that it was simply a cultural practice. But we do have a few examples which are 25, where the cranial volume is 25 to 30% larger than any person of that time. And the shape of them are so natural, or the shapes are so natural looking, that they would be almost impossible to create that shape through force. So I think what we're looking at is we're looking at the remnants of an ancient line of people that died out. And luckily, the Paracas collection has a few of those long-lost relatives.
Now, I noticed you did a tour with Lloyd Pye one time on crystal skulls. Is that right?
No, actually, that's coming up in August.
Okay, we'll plug that too. Is this connected to the crystal skulls?
No, actually, Lloyd's study has been what's called the Star Child, which there's only one of them, and he spent 14 years studying the Star Child, and he's found more than 25 non-human characteristics in it. So that's why he's intrigued to come to Peru to look at the elongated skulls as well.
Okay, now I've got the connection in my mind.
And so, Jerry, there's a question in the chat room from I Just Am.
Yeah.
Let me just read it. So I'll just read the question and answer it myself. I'll be the perfect show host.
Yeah,
Rita, a question for you. Do you think it could be possible that a spirit's energy may stimulate an image in the mind of the intended receiver by using its electromagnetic energy to create the image? Good question. I think that that's possible. I mean, as human beings, we all send, receive, and assimilate information. And so whether you have a physical body or not, you can still send that information, which can be received by, you know, somebody that has a physical body as well. So, yeah, I do believe that they can, you know, create the energy or create the image for you to see. So, yes, very much so.
Yeah, well, I mean, that leads to the question of different realities and what is real and what isn't. A lot of intelligent people deal with that subject. It's beyond my human ken, more or less, but there's a lot of interesting data out there about things like that. So, yeah, that's a good question. Let's get back to the tour itself. Now, they can make the reservations through your website, Rita, and also yours as well. Is that right?
That's
yeah,
correct.
And also there's also Infinite Connections, which is another site, which is on my website, which gives even more details about the tour.
Okay, now what's the deadline on somebody going on this thing? Can they get the last possible minute?
No, we need to have the final people have to be registered 6 weeks in advance. We can't, we need to be able to book all the hotels and things.
So we're only talking a couple of weeks now.
Basically.
Right. So people need to think about it, go over and look at those websites, and think about making that tour. It'd be something that they can remember a lifetime. And let's get into exactly what happens here on the first day, second day, and so forth. What's the deal there? I mean, how does it work?
Well, basically, everyone flies into Lima, which is the capital city of Peru, and we spend a day in Lima itself, and then from there, I have to look up the website here for a second. I've got.
I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah, I got so many different things going on. They all follow the same basic kind of pattern. But it's called, basically the tour is called Forbidden Mysteries of the Ancient, of the Inca World. And the concept is that we're looking at these ancient people called the Viracochas, who were great teachers in mythology. But we believe they were real people prior to the Inca. And so we're going to be following this ancient path and discovering the elongated skulls and the megalithic structures along the way. So we fly to Cusco, and at Cusco is where we see the incredible stonework that the Inca did not make.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but Cusco, is that in the mountains, or is that...
Cusco is inland from the ocean. It's located at 10,000 feet in the Andes.
That's what I was thinking.
And it's the ancient Inca capital.
But you know what? I'm going to just throw in a little UFO thing for you there, Jerry. You know, so they talk about the underground bases, like we were talking earlier about Dolce, you know, and there's supposedly underground bases in Peru, you know, with the entrance going through Lake Titicaca. But there are these tunnels that are well documented, not what's in the tunnels or where the tunnels go, but that there are these tunnels that are all over the Cusco area. And Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they uncover or re-uncover an entrance to one of those ancient tunnels recently?
Yeah, it was actually 10 years ago, but they found both the entrance and the exit. One end of it is on top of this hill called Sacsayhuaman, which has the greatest megalithic stones in the Americas, some stones weighing 125 tons. And the other opening is underneath what is now one of the main churches. So, yeah, they did find the entrance at both ends. The thing is that the Inca filled in both entrances because they hid probably tons of gold in there that has not been found. And the conquistadors never found it. But that's actually one of the small tunnels. The bigger ones go from Lake Titicaca to Cusco, and there are even...
How far is that?
It's about 250 miles.
That's a big tunnel.
Yeah. And again,
How old would that tunnel be?
Well, again, these wouldn't be tunnels that the Inca would have built. They would have inherited them from a much more technologically sophisticated culture. I think they could be 10 or 15,000 years old.
I mean, according to the early Spanish chroniclers, the tunnels were ancient even to the Inca. So how old that is, we don't really know.
Have people been inside these tunnels? I mean, are they accessible? Is there like a flat surface to walk or drive on?
Actually, yeah. I met a man who went into one in 1994. And he only went in part way because it turned into a labyrinth. So he didn't have a flashlight or candle with him. So he went part way, but then turned back because he was afraid of being lost. And there are a lot of stories of people having entered them and never coming back. And that's why the Peruvian government in 1994 sealed all of them off, because they're afraid that tourists or whoever would enter them, probably looking for the lost Inca treasure, and then never come back.
Unless you think the reptilians are down there, and then you'll just get abducted and you'll never come back, and you'll just become, you know, alien food.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well,
there's
actually a lot of people say they've seen reptilians in those tunnels. Not necessarily down there, but around the country. Even one up in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Even up in Missouri, there's a reptilian supposedly came out of a tunnel. I mean, you know, we get all kinds of people reporting things to us. Let's go on with the tour, though, here. The first day you arrive, and what happens? You got a nice hotel you stay in, I know.
Yeah, everyone lands in Lima, and we stay there, and we have a nice tour of the museums that are there, to get an idea of the antiquity of Peru. And then after that, we fly to Cusco, which is the capital. And that's where most of the rest of the tour takes place, looking at the megalithic buildings, elongated skulls, and, of course, visiting Machu Picchu as well. So that's, you know, that's the... of course, for, you know, for real detail, people should look at the actual tour page itself, because it's quite in-depth and... We cover a lot of ground in a very short period of time.
How often do you do tours? I guess on a regular basis, you do this full time, right, Brian?
No, we don't do it full time because my wife and I do 3 to 4 big ones a year of, you know, like 20 to 30 people, and then some smaller ones. But we don't. It would be too much work to do it full time because we have other things we like to do, and we want them to be quality experiences, and we don't want to run a tour company. So they're very personal experiences, sharing our love and knowledge of the area with very special people.
Rita, how did you find Brian?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that the other day, how we actually connected. I mean, I know I've had him on the show several times. So do you remember how we actually connected the first time, Brian?
Well, I guess you weren't even on the show, probably, Rita, and you probably contacted him somehow.
Well, actually, I don't remember exactly, but I do know that we had an immediate connection, and we have had that ever since then. So It's always a pleasure to talk to Rita because of her incredible charm, intelligence, inquisitive mind, and that's why she would be a wonderful person to have here, to share these things with.
Rita, yeah. He needs to be your PR person.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we do that for each other, you know, because I think his work with the monuments down there and especially the elongated skulls, you know, I mean, one of the things he's doing, which, Jerry, you should have him come back on to just do a whole show about the elongated skulls, is that they've been doing some DNA work on the skulls, and I don't know where that is, and you don't have to give away your secrets because, you know, you probably need to do another show when you get all the results in with me. On Just Energy Radio, www.justenergyradio.com.
We're going to have a battle here for guests.
That's right. And, we've really connected just by each other's work. And actually, Brian wrote the foreword to Man-Made, the Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods.
That's true.
He did. So.
Brian, you're not from Peru originally. Not from Hawaii either, are you?
No, I'm from the west coast of Canada.
That's what I was thinking. I thought I read that on a resume or something. So, how did you get interested in Peru?
It's been a lifetime interest in indigenous cultures. Growing up in North America, you know, was a wonderful experience. But I've always been interested in older, I guess you would even call them richer cultures than the one I grew up in, and so I became interested in the native peoples of the Americas, spent some time in Hawaii and Polynesia, and then was just naturally drawn by ancient stories to Machu Picchu in Peru, and I'm working on the connections between all of the Pacific ancient cultures now.
That's what I was trying to say. It seems to me that there is a connection between those Pacific Rim countries and the Pacific itself, and South America, they seem to be intertwined.
Oh, very much so.
And so I it makes you wonder how they got back and forth.
Well, they did a lot of sailing. That's the thing, is that Columbus was very much a latecomer. And according to Hawaiian and other Polynesian traditions, people have been sailing the Pacific for thousands of years. They didn't need to have compasses. They knew how to navigate with the stars. And so that's another clue to the much older history of our planet, is that people were circumnavigating the globe thousands upon thousands of years ago.
Now, well, what's interesting, I'm just going to throw one more thing in, is what's interesting is that where you find the megalithic structures, you would think naturally you would find them in China, Japan, if that's where the culture originated, and then it's stretching out into the Polynesian islands and then to places like Hawaii and Easter Island. But I'm not really aware, other than the agricultural terraces in China and the Polynesian area, of them really having a lot of megalithic structures, but you find those weird stones that you can't quite figure out how they carved them with the 25 sides and fit them together pretty much in Peru and in Easter Island and in Greece and a couple of other places. But you know, that's your primary centers, which leads me to believe that, you know, it was more in the Americas where the major population was and maybe spread the other direction.
Brian,
high-tech to low-tech.
When we talk about the elongated skulls, you mentioned Easter Island. Those elongated skulls look like those spaces on Easter Island?
Yeah, actually, I've been on Easter Island twice and have been able to talk with local people, and they said that in the very distant past, there were a race of people who had elongated skulls, but they died out over time. A long, long time ago. But also, David Hatcher Childress and I wrote a book which covers the entire planetary existence of these elongated skulls, and they were all over the place. They were in ancient Iraq, parts of Europe, Africa, Melanesia, South America, Central America, etc. So it's a question of trying to, time-wise, piece together migration patterns of these very intriguing ancient people.
Do you think they could they have been the giants that we hear about, or
Yeah, they could have actually been descended from the giants, because there are a lot of, again, stories in South America and, of course, in the Americas about these ancient people who were very tall, much taller than most of the Native Americans. And there's also this preponderance of them having auburn red hair, too, which is, of course, not a Native American characteristic.
Well, and then there's some of the material that comes out of Klaus Dohna's work, where he has those giant masks that came out of Bolivia or Colombia, Ecuador, one of them South American countries. And according to Klaus, when you held them up to your face, you couldn't see out the eye hole. But when you held, you know, but when you took into consideration the size that they estimate these giants were to be, you know, the 7 to 12 feet, then they would easily have been able to see through these eye holes. And so that just adds support and evidence that there was something there.
When we talk about the ancient Inca, we talk about the mystical things, like gods walking the face of the earth. But I always think of the gods of mythology as probably being extraterrestrial creatures themselves, and we didn't know else, you know, any other way to describe them. What's you guys' take on all this stuff? I mean, what do you think is happening with as far as you know, the mythology of all of this. I mean, we can look at Greek mythology and Roman mythology, but it's pretty mythical around the world that there were people, you know, riding chariots in the sky and giants and on, you know.
Yeah, well, also, the thing is, what's important about, you know, oral traditions or legends is the fact that they're written as down as poetry. They're not written point by point as facts, and so you have to be able to interpret them. But definitely, when you talk, for example, that like the Titans of Greece, they were clearly beings. They weren't just stories that somebody made up, but you also have normal so-called people always battling these other people, battling the giants, as in David and Goliath, etc. So I think our history is much richer than what we're led to believe, and that there were ancient races of beings or people that were exterminated by probably our ancestors.
Well, you know, I am just working up a new little mini video lesson. If you go to my YouTube page, Just Energy Radio on YouTube, or Science Meets Spirit on YouTube, I've been doing these little video learnings. And so my new one that's coming out talks about why ghosts got the short end of the mythological stick. Because when you look at mythology, there is a belief that there were ghosts, or people were haunted by ghosts from deep antiquity, deep, deep, deep antiquity. However, people believed in the gods. People drew pictures of the gods. People wrote stories about the gods. People decorated cave walls with the gods. They did all this stuff with the gods and not the ghosts. And the question I ask is, if the gods and the ghosts are both these non-corporeal, fictitious, interdimensional being, then why aren't they treated the same? Because they would have appeared to people as being the same, but they're not. And it seems clear from traditional sources that the indigenous people could recognize a ghost, you know, but they venerated the gods. Why is that? I believe it's because at some point in their history, they interacted with these beings, you know, with these physical beings, and those memories have come down to us into the present, you know. But I don't think that they were just like heroes of the past, that they had powers and abilities far beyond mortal man, or at least good tools.
We've only got a few minutes left because I want to do something on what we did last week, a follow-up on the alien reproduction vehicles. We have a man who's put together what hangar S4, all of the hangars here. There's 9 of them, I think, all together at Area 51, and what's in each of those hangars, and which ones did we build vehicles, and which ones came from UFO crashes. That's coming up here in a minute. But before we do that, I would be remiss without asking both of you to run over in kind of a thumbnail fashion the tour and how people can go to it and when the deadline probably is.
Go ahead, Brian.
Okay, well, the tour is an 8-day tour beginning at the beginning of June. And again, it's basically the Cusco and the Sacred Valley area, which is was the domain of the Inca, but also much more technologically sophisticated older cultures. And then after that is a 4-day tour of Nazca, where the famous Nazca lines are, as well as Paracas, which is where there is a very large collection of elongated, mysterious skulls. And that's the Paracas Nazca area is just south of Lima. So basically what we do is everyone flies to Lima. We stay there for a day. Then we go up into the highlands around Cusco and the Sacred Valley for about a week. And then it's back to Lima and then down along the coast to really focus on the elongated skull beings. And that basically winds up the whole thing. And it's a very – there is no one else who offers this kind of tour, because all other tours of Cusco and Peru give you the standard archaeological boring story, which doesn't make any sense anymore.
And you get to hang out with Brian and I, which is very cool.
And the whole thing lasts, you have it in two tiers, and there's an optional part, right? They can stay longer?
Yeah, it's basically 8 days plus 4 days.
So you can come for 8 days or you can stay for 12.
Exactly.
Right.
And so they can...
It's going to be amazing. That's all I can say is it's going to be amazing because, you know, not just the sights and the sounds, but all the things people are going to learn, you know, about these different sites. You know, and earlier, Jerry... You know, I'm looking at the clock for you. Earlier, we were talking about doing the remote viewing, you know, and so we're going to be doing experiments to validate, you know, some of our thoughts, and we're going to have everybody participate in these experiments and bring their questions of what they want to learn about these locations. And so it's going to be really interesting and taking a very different look at these sites, not just from what's going on in the physical, but what's going on in the more etheric realm, the unseen realm. So
sounds good to me. Now give the website so they can check you out.
Okay, go ahead, Brian.
Oh, sorry. Mine is www.hiddenincatours.com.
And mine is www.soulhealer.com, unless you go to www.justenergyradio.com. But you really should go to soulhealer.com because that's the portal to everything, Rita Louise.
Okay.
Right, Gary?
Okay, we got it. Hey, thanks, both of you. I've enjoyed it. It's been an intriguing show. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, thanks for listening. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Cheers.